Before we, I am going to read the lines from the Purgatory that where Dante describes the appearance of the siren. But I also wanted to read you before we did that. I wanted to read you the quotes that I was really looking for yesterday in Paul Homer's book on Lewis, the shape of his faith and thought. I don't know how many of you have seen this book. It's been in the bookstore, and we do have this copy in the library, but I would strongly recommend it. Usually I don't like books about an author like Lewis who is so readable that you don't have to read things about him, because he's good to read. But what I like about Homer is that he gives you some other insights that are not, he gives you insights about literature and how Lewis has affected him that for some of us, we may never have reached that particular point, or we may not have that kind of exposure in our reading. And I thought that I really felt he had done some very perceptive things in this book. One of the things that he talks about quite often is something called the psychomachinations or psychomachia of the person who is reading. And it's a phrase that sounds very profound, so it's very good to have it in your vocabulary. People can be impressed when you see it. But what it means is simply the activities, the inner life of anybody. I mean you and me and everybody else, that we have an inner life that is going on if we're aware of it. And there's a drama in that. A real drama, a real struggle, a real conflict. And what Homer thinks Lewis is concerned about in his writing and in all good literature is that it allows us to see that drama in ourselves, to understand it in a way that isn't just analytical or psychologized or psyched out or something, but that we can laugh at ourselves and think how silly. We can empathize with ourselves and say, well, other people have felt like this, you know. And also you get a sense, sometimes you feel like life is dull or boring or you're monotonous or you're a stupid zero, and then you read something and it begins to point up a lot of things and you think, well, you know, I feel this way. I must not be such a stoop. I must not be so far off. You know, and it gives you a sense of the, sometimes we need that, the sense of the excitement that there is in living, and it calls attention to it in a way that is not sentimental. Now this is, there are two things I want to read from this book before I even read Dante. So it's taking quite a precedence. But the reason I want to read it is because I feel like it's something that, I don't know what you might, I know how many books people recommend you to read, myself included, and I know how long it'll be before you get to them. So I think these little tidbits, I have to be sure you get them now, because you might miss them. This one. This one is about this particular quotation is about the importance of reading, because as we read, we become wise. We actually enter into something, and you don't apply it. You don't learn a theory, as I said yesterday. You don't learn a definition about something, but you actually enter into it in such a way that it happens to you. This I can't emphasize enough, because I wonder if you realize how many lives you can live in reading. You know, we just have one life of our own, but you can multiply your experiences if you read and actually enter into those reading experiences. It doesn't mean, of course, that you have to just, you know, grab onto 150 of them, if the ones that you do read, you really read perceptively and with imagination, you know, it really extends your own sympathies, your own passion, your own understanding of life as it's lived on our planet. And this is one of the things that Homer says is part of Lewis's whole concept of literature. Literature is not dependent then upon theories. More properly, literature does not teach theories in the guise of fantasy and fiction. And this is what I'm so afraid of when we pull this book apart, this Descent into Hell, that you're going to think that it's just a little, it's really a dished out morality or sermon or something, and that what Williams is trying to do is teach you a lesson, and you better get it, and I'm afraid you won't get it, so I'm going to take all the things off and show you what the real structure is. This isn't the way Lewis understood it, nor the way Williams understood it. What they understood in the writing of this kind of fiction or short novel or story or poetry or whatever, is that you actually enter into it, and you enter into it because it's worth doing. Neither is it, therefore, only an emotional expression of the life of the age or the idiosyncrasies of the individual author, which it could be of Williams, because he certainly is idiosyncratic. Literature is produced in a myriad of circumstances and for an indefinitely large number of purposes. An unsuspected consequence of the reading of literature is that it enlarges that everyday capacity for explanation that we already command. It enlarges that everyday capacity for explanation that we already command by thinking and feeling with persons in literary context, not so much the authors themselves, but with the fictional characters, and by the help of the individual poetic lines, we extend pathos, passion, desire, wishes, and we become, ideally, more competent ourselves. Now, I think that you'll probably have to go back and read this over, and I'm not going to take that time today, but the book is in Koinonia, and this is on page 28. It wouldn't hurt you to read the first couple chapters, at least in this book. Literature adds to reality. It does not simply describe it. Now, that's very important, that literature is not, a kind of a little plus, but in which you get a description of how life is. But, I mean, your experience in literature is a real experience. It's not a phony one. I mean, the life that is inside of you is real. It's just as real as when you walk down to Koinonia and walk down to the dining hall and have dinner. It's a different kind of reality, but it's real to you. You're feeding you. You're not just feeding your mind, but you're feeding you totally when you read a book. Just as when you eat a good dinner, you're feeding you totally. You're not just feeding a body. I mean, after all, what would your spirit do, so in quotation marks, if you didn't feed the body? And what would the body be like if the spirit weren't fed? But and that's why this division is so stupid. I mean, when you feed one, you feed the other. It's a total thing. You're not two separate entities. And that's what makes me mad when people, talk about reading as if it were some kind of a little, something you did because you didn't have anything else to do, instead of something that's actually essential for the nourishment of your whole self. As he says, you become ideally more competent yourself because you are an extended person. Now, that doesn't mean that, I mean, a lot of people who are literally bookworms are not all that great people to deal with. They can be really in the corner kind of people that you don't ever want to have anything to do with because they have nothing to say to you. But that's because it's just like people who are gluttons with food. That's all they think about. And there's no real relationship between the whole total being of what they're doing. When they eat, they don't celebrate the food, they just grab. Well, that's the same way with some bookworms. They just grab and grab and grab and get as much inside, and there's no exchange with anyone else. So it's an entirely egocentric process. And this is important to remember so that you don't judge a bookworm, so-called, and say well, that person, all he does is read, and if that person, so for some people, books are an escape, in a sense, from contact with other people because they're still too shy to talk to them. And some people are just not as talkative as somebody like me, fortunately, so there's a chance for me to, you know, fall into a lot. But there's also a difference in personality, so I don't like to say that just because someone likes to stay by themselves and read a lot, that should be labeled negatively as a bookworm. But it's when there is no, you know, when people make a thing of their academics and their scholarship to such an extent that there is no real interchange with other people, then you really are becoming as isolated, finally, as Wordsworth becomes. Literature adds to reality, it does not simply describe it. It enriches the necessary competencies that daily life requires and provides. Now, I don't suppose many people would think that literature actually helps you get through one day of, you know, relationships. But believe me, if you read the right kinds of things, you learn to laugh at yourself, and that is one of the gifts of the Holy Spirit. You know, a lot of people think that the Holy Spirit's gifts are all, you know, speaking in tongues and prophecies, or their love and patience and so on and so on, which is, I mean, they're all there. I don't know why the Lord didn't put you know, a sense of humor, but I think it's because a lot of times people think a sense of humor is laughing at jokes, and they don't realize a sense of humor is laughing at yourself, being able to laugh at yourself, and you're, you know, taking yourself as the most important serious person on earth, the only one that really understands life and so on. Well, I mean, you know, we all go through periods of that. I don't know if it's how young you are or how old you are. I get that way, and Carol gets that way. And sometimes we have to laugh at each other to kind of pull each other out of it. But once in a while, the Lord comes through and helps us laugh at ourselves. It's quite important. And that the literature helps you do that. It enriches the necessary competencies that daily life requires and provides, and in this respect, it irrigates the desert that our lives have already become. And that's a really good statement. It irrigates the deserts that our lives have already become. Now, you may not, some of you may not feel like your lives are such deserts, and you feel pretty well irrigated, but there are times when you really feel like you're barren and dead inside, and literature can actually open that up to you, because it helps you live into other people, and somehow by that actual experience, wisdom comes into your system, into your thinking, not because you've learned it, but because it happens to you. And that's extremely important. The other thing I wanted to read was the difference in sentimental and literature and true literature, and I think this is quite important, although I will say that I think sometimes literature, I don't think that any of us are immune to reading sentimental literature of whatever kind. Now we turn to two related deliberations that are pertinent. We have already said something about a piece of literature being simply an object, that is something that you relate to. As an object, it also begins to create a new consciousness when properly read of the world and oneself. Now I think that's certainly true of the descent into hell. It gives you a different attitude and perspective on the world and yourself if you relate it properly. Literature is not objective quite the way a scientific description is. In fact, it gives us acquaintanceship with people and situations, not theories about them. Literature does that. It gets us used to people.
And sometimes it gets us used to ourselves a little bit. It presents them as subjects and not as objects. Now, this is really important. Nobody is an object. Do you remember when Bonnie had her vespers and she quoted from Martin Buber about this whole business of I and thou-ness and the business of using other people as an object or other, even creation as an object in a sense. And sometimes we use ourselves as objects because we fail to understand our relationship as subjects, as actual livers, so to speak. To say that a piece of art or literature is an object is to say that it is objective about a mode of human subjectivity that its author may or may not share. The reader begins to share the life of the literature. He even has actual emotions and pathos as he reads. Bad literature describes emotions. Good literature so presents situations and contexts that the appropriate emotions happen in the reader. Now that is a very good description of what makes for sentimental reading and what makes actually good reading. Yes, the bad literature describes emotions, and good literature so presents situations and contexts that the appropriate emotion happens in the reader himself or herself. So that it actually, you are entering into that. It's not just something that somebody else it's happened to them and you're weeping over them. Now, it's true that sometimes, you know, you can read literature that people think is very, that's kind of trashy or that's kind of cheap or that's not really very good literature. But it may allow you to enter into that situation. The emotion may really happen to you in a real sense. And at that time, that can be good literature for you. There are real stages on life's way also in reading and as you live. So don't be hard on yourself if you think if something that somebody else says is, oh, that's way back. Oh, I read that a long time ago. Well, I don't think much of that. That kind of damning statement can really, sometimes it can help you. But sometimes it can really knock you out, too, and take the carpet out from under you and feel like you have nothing to stand on anymore. So be careful how you throw judgments around, because you can really really do a lot of damage. But it does give you, you will find that you come to really good literature with a different kind of experience, and it much more an experience in depth, and it can be read again. Good literature can. It isn't the kind of thing that once read, well, that's enough. But you really want to read it over again, and then it's worth it. I want to read. How many of you read the Narnia books? There's. I just want to read this one little thing because it's kind of neat about how Homer describes this. Paul Homer describes the kind of fantasy that Lewis uses. Throughout his writings, Lewis puts an emphasis on a kind of the eventual sort of. The importance of understanding that love and the importance of charity, the real meaning of life, is something that's never going to be vanquished. Throughout his writing, Lewis puts the emphasis in this. The truly wise person will finally be Orwell in Till We Have Faces, Ransom in the fantasy pieces, even Peter in the Chronicles, none of them schoolish metaphysicians. But they are exceedingly well taught. None of them thinks within points of view. Just as self-sacrifice and love for others are not standpoints or religious doctrines, so being wise and understanding are not either. These are ways we must live. These required a tempered spirit and a chastened and well-honed intelligence.
not less, but more. Eustace, a somewhat stubborn boy, says in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader in chapter 14, in our world, a star is a huge ball of flaming gas. He is told by a wiser head, even in your world, my son, that is not what a star is, but only what it is made of. I think that's quite important, that, you know, stars are also wonderful, awesome, and fearful. Stars and moons are many things, and the somewhat inchoate appearing logic of ordinary discourse in everyday life requires appreciation and sensitivity, susceptibility and impressionability like that of the psalmist, of Dante, of myth makers, as well as scientists. And I think this is what is important about all of literature and all, and particularly about the way in which a lot of these things are written, is that they are written because no definition has the final word for it, you know? Even in your world, that's not what a star is. Maybe what it's made of. And that's true of life, you know? You may be able to just get it all straightened out, and then you, what do you have? You still can't say this is what it is. So,
what was that part about being wise and understanding?
Oh, that's exactly where that is. That's in that. It's in that.
That's beautiful, but that's not something.
Did I read that? Yeah. Is that the part I just read before then? I think that's in.
Well, don't, you don't have to.
That's in the. It's in the whole understanding of that reading, that you enter into the experience of all these other people in other worlds and other books. I mean, the books that create other worlds for us, and that as in the process we become wise as we understand these other experiences. They extend us. We're not able to live all these lives, nor are we able to be all these people, but we can project through the imagination, and because it happens to us. It's not something we learn. And that's where literature has a gift that I think we just don't, you know, we don't realize enough when we read that what's happening to us. And I really don't approve of this way of reading a book, you know, that what we're doing with this descent into hell. I honestly think it's just wrong to pick apart any piece of writing in this way. The only reason that I, as I said before, about doing it this way is for the first time you read Williams, you are really inundated with such a flood of different kinds of images and ideas that that you almost need some kind of discussion to break it down. But then after that, when you read these novels of Williams or anybody else, you know, you don't have to pull it apart. You know, read, get as much as you can out of it, and then if you really like it, you can go back and read it again. And you'll find out whether it's, you know, what it's got for you. But I think that some of these things in this book are things that that you need to think about, particularly because since we just read Dante, it is exactly parallels in so many ways the kind of experience that Dante talks about, and that's why I thought it was a good thing to spell it out for you a little bit. I think John will use this in when he talks about Prufrock, because it also has something to do with the poem, and I'm sure he'll draw your attention to it. But I think it's all right to have taken some time to explain some of these terms too that are not really common to us, any of us. We were in chapter 5, and I thought before we talked about the siren and the appearance of this strange person, I thought we should read just that, no, I suppose I hope I don't didn't lose it again. Oh, I wanted to read one thing though. I wanted to read the, did I read that, did I read the part to you on the threshold of ascent from the purgatory yesterday?
Not yesterday.
I talked about it a little bit, but I didn't, discussed the idea of what this threshold of ascent meant, and that ascent was ascent, A-S-S-E-N-T, not, mm-hmm. not progressively up. That this is a threshold in which you decide whether you're going to say yes or no about something. Whether you assent to it or you do not assent to it. And it ends with a T. Now I think I made that clear. In the purgatory, they're discussing what it is that just helps you. I mean, why do you do things the way you do? And as Dante and Virgil are talking about it, they have in the 18th canto a long discussion on free will. And during this discussion, Virgil asks him to explain some of these things. What is it that allows people to have free will? And here's the way it goes. If from without love beckons us to it, to something, and with no choice the soul's foot followeth, go right, go wrong, we merit not a whit. In other words, if something is simply making a demand on us and we just follow it along just like that, we merit not a whit. So much as reason here distinguisheth, I can unfold, said he, Virgil. Thereafter sound Beatrice's mind alone, for that needs faith. To each substantial form that doth compound with matter, though distinct from it, there cleaves specific virtue, integral, inbound, which, save in operation, none perceives. It's known by its effects, as in the plant, now listen, I'm sure you didn't get the first part, but listen to this, which, save in operation, none perceives. It's known by its effects, as in the plant, life manifests itself by the green leaves. So how his intellect made cognizant of the prime concepts, or what guides his aim toward the first appetibles, man's ignorant. In other words, the instinct, you can't see the instinct that is making a plant grow. I mean, you can see them, but you can't see what is it in the plant that makes it get green leaves. Well, you can explain it, but it's like the what the man told Eustace. You still haven't told me what it is. Well, you can describe it, but you haven't told me what it is. And this is what Virgil is telling Dante. You can, what is happening, none perceives, it's just you see the effects of it. And that's the same way with man, that what guides his aim towards something is, you don't know, those are the instincts. Such things are instincts in you, much the same as in bees, the honey-making bent. I mean, you know, Virgil brings you right, I mean, Dante always brings you right down to something that, well, I mean, why do bees make honey? And like when the pool, well, I wonder why it does. You know, well, obviously for bears to eat honey. But that's really the pool's approach. But he really brings you right to the very most normal kind of thing, like honey making. This prime volition earns nor praise nor blame. You see? I mean, you don't say, oh, isn't it wonderful that bee to make honey? Maybe he's a really great bee. What makes that bee so great? Maybe he's a really virtuous bee. You know, it's stupid. You don't say that about bees, or you don't say that even about an animal that goes and takes care of its young. Any more than I really feel that Mother's Day makes any sense. Because I've always felt that mothers are following their instincts. You know, I mean, we take care of our children because it satisfies a deep instinct within us. I mean, if we don't, well, of course there are perverse people that don't, but most mothers who really want to be satisfied with themselves are going to follow that instinct. It's an instinct. And oh, that's big. Well, of course, that's good for people to say thank you. But anyway, those are instincts, you see. They are real. That's not something that you necessarily compliment a creature for when it follows its instincts. Now, to keep all volitions else well blent with this, you have a counselor power innate set there to guard the threshold of ascent. Now, this is in the purgatory, and you don't have that. A lot of you don't have this, probably, maybe you haven't bought it, but it's almost worth it just for this particular, these cantos right in the middle here. But you have a counselor power innate set there to guard the threshold of ascent. How many of you have seen The Godfather or read it or know something about it? Remember the, what do they call the guy that was, you know, that was always the one that had to decide? Now, come, I have to have a talk with you. What's his name, always? What do they call him?
Mongren.
Not his own name. I'm thinking of the, of the, what did they, what was it? Consil, what's his Italian, there's an Italian name for him. He's the counselor, but he had an Italian name for him. What? Anybody in the outer reaches? Well, anyway, that's typical of it doesn't mean that you have to be in the mafia to understand this, but this idea of a counselor is that there the in this Italian idiom at least, it's somebody who is there to kind of give you some counsel to think about something, weigh both sides of a question, and then make a decision. And this is what this counselor did in the, you know, The Godfather was always, as I recall, he was having, you know, whenever they were going to have something, well, Consiglione. Yeah, I can't remember that. I mean, it just, you know, you realize the creeping effects of age, but then you can't remember it either, so that's not so bad.
We all age.
Not all age. But the idea of a counselor power is that of a, of someone who is giving help in thinking something out, you see? And this you have. You have this within you. This is your ability as a human being to make a decision. And you are responsible for your decisions, you see? But you do have the possibility of thinking something through and making a decision or delaying a decision until you've thought it through some more. You see? I mean, these are all things that can happen at the threshold of ascent. In other words, you don't go by instinct. You know, you just don't go pell-mell into whatever, unless, you know, you want to live an animal life. But you don't do that. As a human being, you have this ability of free will to think something through. And this whole idea of this threshold in which you do have a counselor, you do have a guardian sort of, not that this is somebody from the outside, but it's something that God has given us to think about what we're going to do so that we're not just, we don't live an animal life of instinct. We don't just go by prime volition, but we go according to actual decisions that require thought because we know we are responsible people. And this is part of that is the principle to which relate all your deserts, according as it stands, strict to purge right loves from reprobate. And he goes on and talks about this all the way through, about how important that is, that you understand that the decisions you make are important and that you can make them, you see, because you are a human being. You're not a bee, in other words. Then I wanted to read the explanation that Dorothy Sayers gives of the penance of sloth. This is the image that is in the cornice of sloth is what the people who are progressing through purgatory are on when Dante writes this little song of the siren that is illustrated really in the descent into hell. But I want to read this little thing from her note on the images here, because it's an awfully good idea. We don't think about sloth as being this kind of thing. The penance of sloth, ceaseless activity. The sin which in English is commonly called sloth or sloth, and in Latin, acidia, is insidious and assumes such protein shapes that it is rather difficult to define. It is not merely idleness of mind and laziness of body, which is what most of us think about. When we say somebody is slothful, well, you know, they're just lazy and don't do anything. It is that whole poisoning of the will, which beginning with indifference in an attitude of I couldn't care less, extends to the deliberate refusal of joy and culminates in morbid introspection and despair. One form of it, which appeals very strongly to some modern minds, is that acquiescence in evil and error which readily disguises itself as tolerance. Another is that refusal to be moved by the contemplation of the good and beautiful, which is known as disillusionment, and sometimes as knowledge of the world. Yet another is that withdrawal into an ivory tower of isolation, which is the peculiar temptation of the artist and the contemplative, and is popularly called escapism. The penance assigned to it takes the form of the practice of the opposite virtue, an active zeal. Note that on this cornice alone, no verbal prayer is provided for the penitents. For them, to labor is to pray. And it's really quite interesting that this kind of an explanation of this particular sin is that you don't talk about it. You don't even pray about it. You just work your way out of it. And it's a kind of an interesting angle on that whole approach. Well,
it's awful.
It's true though.
I know it's
well,
true.
Well, it doesn't have to be true just because Dorothy Sayers said it. Don't think it's true, and don't think Dante always tells the truth either. I mean, you have to decide yourself what's true, you know. Not all this is, you know, something that's laid out in just because it's in black and white in print doesn't mean it's true, but it does have a lot to do with the truth of our own natures, I think. From Canto 19, this is the song that the siren sings in the purgatory, really has tremendous effect on Dante. Now, the problem you will see is very similar to that of Wentworth, and it's exactly at the same time of day that he is attacked. What hour the heat of day can warm no longer the chill moon's influence because the cold of earth, or sometimes Saturn's power is stronger. When geomancers looking east behold their greater fortune rising through a reach of sky that darkness cannot long enfold. In dream, a woman sought me, halt of speech, squint-eyed, unnamed feet, lurching as she stepped with crippled hands and skin of sallowy bleach. I gazed, and as to cold limbs that have crept heavy with night, the sun gives life anew, even so my look unloosed the string that kept her utterance captive, and right quickly drew upright her form, that all misshapen hung, and stained her withered cheek to love's own hue. The whole projection of Dante on this terrible creature produces a beautiful creature. And that's exactly what Wentworth did, you know? Then she began to sing, when thus her tongue was freed, and such a spell she held me by as had been hard to break, and so she sung. Lo, the sweet siren, yea, tis I who lead the mariners in mid-sea astray. Such pleasures in my melting measures lie. I turned Ulysses from his wandering way with music. Few, I trow, to me who grow know how to go. longing I so allay. Her lips yet moved that melodious flow, when hard at hand a lady I espied, holy, alert, her guiles to overthrow. Oh, Virgil, Virgil, who is this? She cried, indignant. He came with heedful eyes on that discreet one, and on naught beside. The first he seized, and rending her disguise in front, showed me her belly, which released so foul a stench, I woke with that surprise. Now that's really a messy section, I think. And it's messy in the book, I think, too. I think that return to Eden has always been an awful chapter. But it does, it's exactly the projection of Wentworth on what he wants, what he can control. And so even when it's something that's dirty and awful, he makes it into something that he wants. Because that's the spell of allowing your own desires to be the decisive thing in your life. You know, I mean, everything that you want, you finally project so that you become totally encased in your own ego. And it's a terrible thing. Because, do you know what is lost here? Is that this projection that Wentworth has is no longer has the ambiguities and the contradictions of an other person. You see? I mean, because if you, one of the first things he says to her when he talks to her, when he talks to this woman on page 82, when he looks out the window and he says, "You're not Adela." And the voice said, "Adela." And Wentworth understood that Adela was not enough, that Adela must be something different, even from Adela, if she were to be satisfactory to him. Something closer to his own mind and farther from hers. She'd been in relation with Hugh, and his Adela could never be in relation with Hugh. He had never understood that simplicity before. It was so clear now. He looked at the woman opposite and felt a stirring of freedom in him. He said, "You waved," and she, "Or didn't you wave to me?" He said under her eyes, "I didn't think you'd be any use to me." Now, you know, that's about as clear a picture of how a man is looking at a woman. "I didn't know you'd be any use to me." See, I mean, there's no real exchange or relationship. It's just, how can I use you? I didn't think you could. I mean, she laughed. And then she goes right on and says, you know, "Whoa, you." She talks very much like somebody else.
Yeah.
Who talked like this earlier in the play, in the book?
Yeah.
This lady that talked to Pauline, remember? Lily Samuel. She says, "Oh, come on, I can give you a lot of good dreams. I'll take care of you. You just don't ever have to have any bad feelings." And this is exactly almost a duplication, and then you'll find that they take this little walk and they go into this funny little shed, and you know that, and Wentworth goes with her, and this is the same shed that Lily hauls people into at the end, you know, and that's where she is, you know, where this awful, terrible woman is sitting, and you finally find her at the end of the book. So it's, you see, that this image comes all the way through, and the awfulness of it.
How is he so deceived? I mean, how is he so? It's because he wants to be deceived.
Because he wants to be. You can be deceived by anything. If you really give yourself to it, you can be deceived by your own projections. You know, your daydreams can become absolutely the only thing you want to live with, whatever the daydream happens to be. Because it's something you can control.
Mm-hmm. But her words he knew they were true.
I mean, he knew they were true because he wanted them. That was truth for him.
So that means you can't really, makes it awfully difficult to judge.
Well,
now, I mean, if I'm deceiving myself, then how can I know when I'm deceiving myself and when I'm not, if
exactly.
They sound true?
Very true. What you have to do when you ask yourself, are you deceiving yourself, you have to ask yourself, how does this put me in relationship with the other? I mean, you have to ask yourself, is this for my personal aggrandizement or for myself, or is this really something that I can honestly say has a good relationship with an other, whether it's one person or society or what have you? Because the one thing that this whole story of Wentworth does is emphasize the egocentricity, the total egocentricity of this man and of people who give themselves to daydreams as a totality. The kind of daydream, not daydreams that are, you know, but everybody has daydreams, and everybody goes to sleep sometime or other with a daydream in the past or the future or something. But I mean, where it becomes an actual living preoccupation, so that you shut out other people from life because you'd rather live with yourself than have to put up with all this business of adjustment, which you have to do if you're going to live with people. And he says, this Adela is so much better Adela than the real one. She's really got, you know, she's got exactly what he wants. Mm-hmm. There's never been an Adela like this, so like Adela as this one was. You know what you really got? That's a crazy thing. And then on page 83, you know, I told you that he has this completely, he uses these almost Joycean, the rhythmic thing there is just like, it almost, well, it could easily put you to sleep if you were, you know, reading it at night. No, but the true Adela who was a part in his, for that was the difficulty all the while, that she was truly his, and wouldn't be. But if he thought more of her truly being, and not of her being untruly away, on whatever way, for the way that went away was not the way she truly went. But if they did away with the way she went away, then he could be untrue and she true. Then he would know themselves two, true, and two on the way he was going. And the peace in himself, and the scent of her in him, and the her meant for him in him. That was the she he knew, and he must think the more of himself. Well, you know, by that time, a faintness does grow around them, but it also grows around you. but it's really, you know, it's really neat, because it's exactly the kind of an incantation that the whole, you know, the whole mood is. It's real.
I didn't hear that.
Well, of course you didn't hear it, because you have to read it out loud. It just looks like, oh no, he's just adding up more words. Let's skip it. And you can, you know. Perfectly right to skip it. Sure. I mean, I don't think it's funny to skip it. I would. I'm sure I did the first time I read it. I was in much too much of a hurry to get through with this terrible chapter. Find out what the next one was. One thing I wanted to mention in this first, on page 76 there of chapter 5, that his luck wasn't any worse than any others. Though the hastening of time to its end made it more strange, it grew in him like all judgment through his negligence, a thing of which he had consistently refused to be aware. If action is a test of awareness, drew close to him, that is, the nature of the Republic. The outcast of the Republic had climbed a forlorn ladder to his own death. His death entered into the Republic, into the lives of its other members. Wentworth had never acknowledged the unity. And then down here, he had never acknowledged the victims of oppression nor the presence of victimization. It may be that such victimization is inevitable, and that the Republic, after its kind, must be as false to its own good as the lives of most of its children are to theirs. But Wentworth had neither admitted nor rejected this necessity, nor even questioned and been hurt by it. He had merely ignored it. Now, this is important because it applies to all of us. It isn't something that's just Wentworthian, you see? I mean, this ignoring and sort of immunization of all of our sensitivities toward the needs of the Republic or society. I mean, we don't, you know, well, victimization of all these people doesn't really have much to do with us. And I think we feel, and I have been using that as an excuse for myself, that My feelings have been immunized by too much TV, exposure to all the stuff in the world, all the suffering and all the misery and the newspapers, and you get actually glutted with it. So finally you have no more emotions left of compassion. But what Kierkegaard says and what Williams says and all these people are continually reiterating is feeling isn't the name of the game. You know, you just don't wait till you feel compassion. You start living it, regardless of how you feel. And that's, you know, certainly a gritty thing to have to think about. But, you see, by neglecting it, you finally get to be a totally, you know, self-centered person that has nothing to do with anybody. Wentworth had neither admitted nor rejected this necessity, nor even questioned and been hurt by it. He had merely ignored it. You see, you aren't really nasty people and say, I'm wealthy, I'm well off, I'm an American, I live where I do, I don't have to think about anybody else. I mean, you don't make that, you know, you don't say anything like that. We are all sentimentally alert to what goes on. You know, we say, oh, is it awful? But you know, as far as doing, that's another matter. I mean, so that we actually think through problems and try to figure out what can be done. He had refused the agony of the res publica and of temporal justice. Another justice sharpened the senses of his res privata. Now the res privata, you can imagine what that means. It's his own private affairs. That was important. That was what was really there. He was doubly open to its approach in his scholarship, where the ignoring of others began to limit color and falsify his work, and in his awareness of supernatural neighbors, if any should be near, one was. And that was the problem of the dead man. But anyway, this whole...
So he was supposed to be open to that dead man?
Well, he wasn't necessarily open to this dead man, but the thing is, that he wasn't open to anybody that was going to be a bother to him. You see, anybody that infringed on his own private affairs or what he wanted to do. And so he would rather live for himself, which we all would. You know, we really all want to live for ourselves. It's like how many of you saw the movie?
Oh, good.
I'm sure you saw it one time or another, the Cardinal. Did you see it one day or another when it was here? I mean, what he finally was saying was simply admitting that I am a sinner. You see, I'm a sinner, and that's where I'm at. And Jack Hawkins was able to use this, what he said was his humility, but which was just his open admission of who he really was. But then, you know, when he walked out, he realized that he had also told his congregation that, remember, whatever I say, it's a lie, and I've been pushed to it because of some situation. But really, what the cardinal talked about when he talked about himself, although the facts, he sometimes, some of the facts were certainly lies because he hadn't betrayed his underground or anything like that, but his own inner life, he had admitted that he was completely bereft, that he was empty, and this is exactly where we are. I mean, if we're going to be honest, we have to admit that we, you know, our insides are really ravening wolves. I mean, we really are always out for ourselves. We're all Wentworths in some form or another, you know, we don't come out that way, but we have those tendencies. And that's the great thing about the gospel, is that you don't have to pretend that you're not a Wentworth. See, Wentworth thought he just had to be somebody. He'd never occurred to him the gospel had anything to do with him. But the gospel did, and the gospel could have reached him. Because the wonderful thing is that we're like the stuff that I buy I buy most of my clothes in secondhand stores, and they always have a little thing. They have a price on it that says as is on it, because that means that if you find a hole in it, or you find a spot on it, you can't bring it back and say there's a spot on this. You know, you take it as is when you buy it cheap. Well, I mean, that's what the gospel does to us. I mean, it takes us as is, with all our spots and holes and everything. You know, we no fooling. You know, we don't have to fool the buyer. But I mean, God's our buyer, and He's willing to take us as is. And that's why I say you can be with us honestly inside and admit it, just as the cardinal admitted that he was capable of all this sin that he talked about last night, even if he hadn't extended it all.
Mary, I don't understand how that connects to the fact that the congregation thought it was a lie.
Well, because
he had said beforehand, he had told them, uh-huh. But he had told them beforehand that you know, when he made that little statement, the things that were the lies were when he said that he had robbed the poor box in the church, and he bribed people. All those things were external, crimes that he was being punished for by the state. What he was saying inside of himself was, this is possible to me as a sinner to have done all this. I haven't done it. He was really when he was praying, in his cell, he just said, God, take me back. You know, he wanted to get back to Him, to His relationship with Him. Totally. The problem with that kind of moving is, unless you've been in a situation where you are either in solitary confinement or you've been in very severe malnutrition, which we were in prison camp, you don't realize the kind of things that happens to your body and soul as they go through this process. This is a case where the feeding of the body again affects the feeding of the soul. You know, where it's one being. You really become almost in despair, because you have no energy left. And you think really not at all the way you would think ordinarily. And so I think that's
Is that why he was able to confess to those things?
He'd been drugged. See, he got this drug, you see, and he didn't know it. And so all the stuff came out as a complete, washover from the way he'd been treated. But at the same time, he himself could say, I'm a sinner. You know, I have this possibility within me of all these things. But as far as the actual crimes were concerned, he hadn't done any of those. See, he hadn't done any of the kinds of things that he was being punished for. And the congregation knew that.
And so did the interrogator.
Yeah. Oh, sure, the interrogator knew that. He knew that all the time.
Mm-hmm. I've got questions from page 69.
All right.
I'm still in
vision. Fine. Mm-hmm. 69.
The fact that love is more mathematical than poetry, that section, I didn't understand. Top paragraph.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Where she says, the best maxim towards that knowledge was yet not know thyself of the Greek so much as the know love of the Christian. That one?
Yeah.
Though both in the end were one, it was not possible for man to know himself and the world except first after some mode of knowledge, some art of discovery. And you remember that we said that discovery is the word that we use when we think about the way in which these images are become for us the way of knowledge. You discover in the way the images are used in this book or Lewis or any book you read, whether it's Shakespeare or anything, that you discover something else underneath that gives you a truth, some mode of knowledge. The most perfect, since the most intimate and intelligent art was pure love. The approach by love was the approach to fact. To love anything but fact was not love. Love was even more mathematical than poetry. It was the pure mathematics of the spirit. It was applied also and active. It was the means as it was the end. The end lived everlastingly in the means eternally in the end. By being more mathematical than poetry, what what Williams is trying to get across is that love is not something in its reality, when you get right down to it, it's a fact and not something that you imagine. No matter how much you interpret it imaginatively, the actual fact of love is as mathematical as 1 + 1 = 2. I guess it still does. No, I don't know what they did with mathematics.
Is that related to the Tao?
To the what?
To the Tao?
Well, I don't know the Tao very well. But it could be. I mean, I don't know much about that.